Hello and welcome to The Stack. I must say, it's a pretty cool show today. We'll cover only the good things in life, music, wine, and gay bars. I speak with Carole Boynet from my favorite music and culture title, Les Incorruptibles. I also taste some wine from Chateau Monestier Latour with Chandra Kurt. They have a new book out published by Assouline. And finally, a new book celebrating gay bars. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. First on the show, a weekly title that I am a huge fan, Les Incorruptibles. Every week they deliver incredible music tips with impressive coverage of music, film, TV and books. The French title, founded in 1986, remains a stronghold for music fans out there. I had the pleasure to interview their deputy editor, Carole Boynet.
Since the very beginning of the magazine in 1986, the goal is to talk about various types of music that are maybe very exigent, kind of radical, in a way that we want to talk about art and not really about entertainment or mainstream stuff. You know, we want to talk about things that say something about the world, about art, etc. And then the magazine, which started as a music magazine, became very quickly a multidisciplinary magazine. So talking about cinema, about visual arts, about theater, dance, etc., etc. And I think this is very unique, like to be able to buy a magazine and to find that many doors which you can open and that lead you into very different worlds, but are all connected by the title, Les Incorruptibles, and our love of, exigent, I think, art.
I was going to ask, actually, what does the title mean? I mean, do you know, if you translate to English, what would it be, more or less?
It's, how do you say that in English, a pun word? It's a pun, you know? About incorruptible. It's like, how do you say that in English? I'm sorry. Do you have the translation? I'm gonna
No, that's okay. I mean, it's just I never quite got it. But don't worry about it. It's and I have to say, I mean, you're very rightly said. I mean, I said music magazine at the beginning, but you're covering everything. I believe I even got a newsletter this week. Your latest issue is about the Césars or
yes.
Film. What is the latest cover again?
It's Roche Dizem. He is a French actor, and he will present our big ceremony, a cinema ceremony, which is called the César, and which is due to happen on Friday. And so we talked with him very extensively. It's a long interview. That's what we cherish at Les Incorruptibles since the very beginning. It's very deep and very long interviews. We like to take time with artists, quality time. We are absolutely not fond of press junkets. We try to avoid them. We don't like to go into hotel lobbies, you know, and just sit for 5 minutes. Like yesterday night, I was talking with Kevin Shields, the leader of My Bloody Valentine, which is a band that we really love at Les Incorruptibles since the 90s. And we talked together for 4 hours on the phone. And I think this is Les Incorruptibles. I think this is, at least this is what I want to leave and what I want to give to the readers.
Well, and as a reader myself, I could feel that. I mean, the previous edition was, of course, a special about Daft Punk. I mean, it was so in-depth. I mean, it wasn't just kind of a little bio of them and their relevance. I mean, if you're a fan, I mean, I recommend whoever to buy, you know, from the previous editions. That was a fantastic one. I wanted to say that as well.
Thank you very much.
And Carole, I love how you also introduce new music. Of course, we just mentioned you did an edition about Daft Punk. But for me, I like to keep on track about what's happening in the music scene. And I love, there's a session that you do almost every issue where you and other editors select like a little playlist, what's playing on your kind of
playlist at home. I love that. It's very short, but kind of very useful for readers, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. And we also have a section in which we present a very young artist who is releasing, for instance, a first album or a first movie, or it's dedicated to young artists. And I think it's very important. We put like a big photo and a short text presenting the person. And I think this is also the main goal of Les Arts Occultibles, is to like be a kind of curators of our world. There are so many information, so many music, so many works of art everywhere. And we try to select things that appear to be very interesting for us and to offer them to the readers, yes. And I think in France, it's particularly important because there are not so many magazines or medias talking about young artists, you know? And I think it's very interesting, especially now that there are no gigs and there are nothing for them, especially now, it's very important to support them and to put a little light on what they are trying to do.
I was going to ask, during this year, kind of a lot of lockdowns around the world, Les Inrocks, how did it work? Because of course there was an impact on newsstand sales. I mean, did you increase your number of subscriptions instead? How did it impact your title? And as you said, there was no gigs, you know, there were quite a lot of things related to music, film, they were affected as well.
Yeah, it's very hard for cultural press. Of course, yeah, we have more and more subscribers. So that's really positive. And I think this is maybe the future of press magazine, you know, because people don't really go now into kiosks. And I think they prefer to like be a subscriber to a title. That's maybe a new adventure for us. But what is particularly difficult is that there are not so many news. In music, it's okay because you still have the CDs and the tracks that are released. But like talking about cinema or visual arts or dance, theater, there are absolutely nothing to say apart from saying that the situation is very tricky. So we try to like lead huge stories, historical stories about past works of art, or try to find different angles, you know, to give to the readers. But yes, it's very weird situation for everyone, of course, but especially in the cultural press, I think.
And now a question that I wonder if it's more kind of about the French people in general, or just Les Inrocks. Because one thing I like about the title as well, that of course you have French artists, you know, American, British, but it feels quite international. You know, for example, I'm from Brazil, reading the titles, you always feature kind of, you know, a Brazilian documentary that perhaps was not even mentioned here in the UK, or something from countries that you wouldn't expect, you know, a little bit of Afropop. I quite like that internationalist aspect. Do you think that's the French? Because, you know, when I go to France, I go to a CD shop, there's music from all around the world. I mean, it's quite vast, actually, their international selection there.
Yeah, I think at least for Les Inrocks, I think we have to be very open-minded about the world. And it's not only Occidental world. The world is vast and it's amazing. And that is the beauty of the world, you know? Like, for instance, I'm very interested nowadays about Amapiano, which is a kind of musical style coming from South Africa, but also different countries of Africa. And I think I will write a feature about that. And I think this is our role as a cultural journalist, you know, to like be aware of everything and try to bring that into our magazine and onto our website and videos and everything, and to give all those doors again to the readers. I want to give doors to the readers with a key on the door that they can open and leading to very different kind of worlds.
I mean, compare here to the UK, you know, we still have some good music press, but I feel that the main newspapers, they are kind of grabbing all this kind of the great interviews with musicians. I mean, there are some magazines there, but it's so cool that you're still doing on your magazine. You know, it's not, you don't need to read, you know, Le Monde or Libération to, you know, to get this amazing cultural coverage as well.
Yeah, I hope so. But I think it's really cool to have a plurality of titles in a country. I think this is the richness of medias nowadays. And it's great to have like Libération, to have Le Monde, but also to have Les Arocs, which is maybe more, I don't know, maybe more exigent or it's different. It's a different way of writing. It's a different way of introducing stuff. Everything is different. For instance, in Les Arocs, we try not really to talk about things we don't like, just because we think that a magazine is short and that we want to give to people things that are very important to us, you know? So this is, for instance, one of Les Arocs' cultible way of thinking, you know?
That was Carole Bonnet, deputy editor of Les Inhu Cuptibles.
And now we head to the Périgord region of France, a paradise for gourmands, wine lovers, and history buffs. Château Monestier Latour's heritage is as rich and elegant as the wines it produces. Written by Swiss wine expert Chandra Kurt, a new book explores the Château legacy, and the wine tastes pretty good too. Here is Chandra and the owner Carl Friedrich Schaffel.
This project is a dream project because, first of all, it's an international project. I could be part of the growth and the creation of a winery that was restored by the family Schäufele. And we didn't only speak about wine, but also about the region, the landscape, the food, the biodynamic wine growing. You know, it's like a universe of its own. And I think when you can give to the reader this universe, they will even love the wine better after. Because wine is not just wine, it's so many, many things around. And also to follow the family and how they work with it and what they invest, it's wonderful.
And Carl, I have to ask you, so it's very interesting that you are also involved kind of in watchmaking. And even look at the wine, beside the taste, which I really, really enjoyed. I mean, on the Cadran's wine, there's like the lovely sundial. I love that detail on the label. How is it to combine kind of this kind of watchmaking and now winemaking as well? I think you're one of the few people that managed to combine both of them.
Well, look, obviously, watchmaking is my main occupation, but there are certain similarities. And one of them is that winemaking is pretty precise. It's a discipline. When you make intricate mechanical watches, it's also a discipline, and you have to be precise in what you do. Big difference is that in winemaking, you are dependent on nature, whereas in watchmaking, of course, you are dependent on human performance and the attention to detail that the watchmaker and everyone involved is paying. That's a big difference. Now, in the winemaking makes you very humble, because even if you do everything right, even if you are really well into the season, you may have some kind of fatal moment in which everything you did right is gone in a matter of hours.
Yeah, you can have a hailstorm.
We had in 2013 a hailstorm, yeah. And that was just before the harvest. And I mean, that was devastating for everyone involved. And actually, we were there. We were on the estate, and we were just about to go out. And all of a sudden, this hailstorm came along, and literally an hour later, everything was kind of, we were facing another situation. And interesting enough, the neighbors all from all around came and offered their help. You know, I learned a lot making wine, and as I said, the similarities are there. And there is a motto that we have in the winery. In French, it's ce qu'on fait avec du temps, le respect. What you do with time, time will respect. And I think I didn't invent this. It was a French sculptor, Rodin, who invented this. But I think he is perfectly right.
Chandra, I would like to ask you, so I mean, you've been working with Wine. I know we were supposed to actually meet in person for the release of the book and everything. How did the pandemic kind of influence your work and also Carl's work as well? Because at the same time, we can't do wine tasting in person. Visits, you know, to chateaus are harder as well. But people, I noticed that around the world, they are drinking more. Perhaps they're finding out more about wine, perhaps in numbers that we never seen before. So I'm not saying the pandemic, you know, helped the industry in general, but I'm just saying there's been a huge surge in interest in the world of wine in general, I would say, right?
Yeah, you know, my main work is the publishing. So what we realized that we spend much more time in for the magazine, and it becomes bigger and bigger because people read also more and they cook at home. So a cookbook is actually a very interesting book right now. They cook more, they enjoy wine because they cannot go outside and enjoy wine. So they do the pleasure at home, which I fully understand. And then you want to know more about wine. So for our magazine, we could feel that the interest even increased. For me as a person that loves to go to visit wineries and to speak on the place, it was a difficult year and I missed a lot of personal contacts. But of course, we can do online tastings, which we do. But it's never the same when you are there and you feel the air, you feel the soil, you smell the nature around. So it's a difficult year, but still wine is a very topic that is very actual.
The interest in wine has increased this year. I mean, all through last year, and we actually sold more wine than ever to private individuals, private customers. Obviously, we didn't sell very much wine to hotels and restaurants. That is the other side. But the interest of these individuals towards wine has grown. And all of them had time to look at their private cellars and to decide that actually they were missing quite a lot of interesting additions. So we actually did we had a good year. What I miss most is the exchange, the direct human exchange. I mean, it's great to see you on the screen, but we would have preferred to share a meal with you here in our wine bar today, you know. But
I prefer as well, for sure.
Yes.
Well, and talking about meals, I mean, the book is amazing. And actually, I have to say, I was a bit surprised because there's incredible recipes as well. So in a way, I mean, if you're having a glass of wine while reading the book, I mean, amazing, that food. I mean, do you serve this food at the chateau as well?
The recipes all come from the gentleman who takes care of the chateau and who actually cooks for us and for the visitors. We persuaded him to actually write them down with us because most of the recipes he always did basically by...
Like an artist, you know?
Like an artist. Yeah. And so it took some persuasion and some time to actually put everything on paper. But this is the food that we are lucky enough to eat when we go to the chateau. We never spend too much time there because otherwise we would gain too much weight.
Yeah. And I could eat all these dishes, and it was amazing also watching the chef. You know, you see the kitchen is in the middle. There's the big table and the big chimney fire around. And
there's a picture in the book.
You know, and he was like a dancer. He went from one pot to another and he brought this dish and then he brought that dish. And then the next dish in while.
And Jacques is his name, Jacques. He's also in the book, so you can see his expression.
And when he sent us the recipes, you know, like an artist, he said, yeah, take a little bit of this, take a little bit of that. And then, you know, you cannot write a recipe, take a little bit of this. So we had to communicate a little bit, you know, what does it mean? Yeah. 10 grams or a half a kilo or... Really, so you can redo the recipes. But I tell you, it's you have to try some of them because it's really... It brings you to the region then.
And Chandra, where you know, so the book is out now. I think it's such a wonderful project that you both did with Vasuline. Where is it available? Is it available on their website and hopefully in their shops as well? I mean, depending on the laws of each country.
No, you find it online and you find it also under Vasuline, I think, .com.
Yeah, Vasuline.com, yeah.
And there is the Maison Vasuline in London. You have it. You get it
in Paris.
In Paris, yeah. Also. And I'm doing my website with this time now. Also new, so soon it's also on my website. And you find the book.
You just told me that it sold out in the US.
In the US, I heard they sold it out already. But in Europe, we find the book.
We will make sure that they get some more books to the US.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Thanks to Chandrakirt and Carl Friedrich Schaffel. Their book with Asseline, Château Monestier-Latour, is out now. And now a little tour through gay bars. Jeremy Atherton Lynn has a new book out, Gay Bar, Why We Went Out. The book is Atherton Lynn's exploration of gay bars in London, Los Angeles, and San Francisco that shaped both these three cities and Jeremy's own life. A great read. And here's Jeremy telling me more about the book.
I think one of the things that's very particular about my story is that, I was taken out. I didn't kind of necessarily seek it out. And I think you hear a lot of narratives around finding a gay bar, especially from maybe the generation above me, that's very much about, I don't know, being an intrepid flaneur and an adventurer and finding your way and doing it all with a lot of agency and determination, which is so admirable. But by the time that I arrived to the scene, it was more sort of like, I don't know, people just kind of decided that I was probably gay and shoved me into the back of a sedan and took me along. You know what I mean? And it was like kind of, and I think I'm in a lot of ways, my kind of character or my narrator throughout the book isn't always sort of in charge or fully certain about how I feel about a situation. I'm kind of continue to be taken along for a ride throughout the book. And in LA at the time, yeah, it was just, I mean, I'm mixed race and it was very white. I wanted to identify because it was the idea of identifying with gay was exciting, but I was put off by a lot of the culture. I had just as much fun going and listening to bands and so on. But I think what happened when I wrote the book is a lot of the very places that I describe in the book as being kind of generic and banal and disappointing are the ones where I realized there was so much history before my time there. Incredible history. I mean, you know, people practicing moves that led to voguing and that they took onto Soul Train, the American Black music television show, national TV. But also, you know, really problematic histories. Racism at the door and all kinds of problems like that.
And that's one of the cool things about the book as well. It's not just kind of a clean cut book about the gay scene, you know, so you really go into kind of details. And I think you've mentioned that as well, that, you know, sometimes the press these days, there's a certain stereotype of gay that you have to be kind of this cookie cutter style, queer eye kind of in a way, right?
Oh, definitely. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I think has happened over the years in various ways, and it takes place in my book and in years and decades past, but I think also permeates today, is kind of desexualization of gay identity. Like, you know, I think people are surprised. I mean, I overheard, I listened to a podcast about my book where a few different critics were talking about my book. And one of them had this gripe where he felt like, I don't know, like it was too horny. Like he was frustrated that one of the main impulses of my character or narrator in the book was to go out and pull. And it was just like astonishing to me, like that's, you know, sure, there's this great cultural advances that come out of the scene, but at its root, it's a sexual identity, right?
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, how strange. Strange comment. I do have to agree. That
one. Also, I mean, who would want to read that book, that version of the book?
Exactly, the you know, the clean-cut version. And you know, besides, of course, Los Angeles, there are, you also pay attention to London, which is where you're based now, and to San Francisco as well. Did it differ that much when you came here to London compared to what you were used to in Los Angeles? Or do you think it kind of felt the same?
Oh, no, it was different. I mean, and also London, you know, there's a section in London in the 90s when I meet my partner, and then my partner comes and lives in San Francisco, and then we come back. And so not only is London different from San Francisco in the book. So this is like 2007 that I moved back to London, or he moved back to London and I came with him. Not only is London different from San Francisco, but London is so different than what it had been before. You know, there was a cool scene in East London, but even then, like, it was so different from San Francisco. I mean, I have to say, I think one of the main differences probably, and this has certainly changed, but when I came to London in 2007, it was really dominated by gay men. And in San Francisco, I was hanging out in a lot of places that had a really wide variety of kind of queer identities and trans identities and lesbians. And, you know, yeah, there was a lot of sort of, I don't know, it almost felt kind of like San Francisco was ahead or something. And it was a bit like stepping back into like the gay men's, you know, world in London. But in other ways, it had totally changed. I mean, Shoreditch was incredible. It was so much fun. And like, I think one of the other things also is San Francisco is, it's kind of a small town. And in London, the gay scene really crosses over with the fashion scene. So I think that was a huge difference. Like when you're hanging out in San Francisco, you feel like you're hanging out in a dive bar that only people in the know have ever heard of, with a gang that just kind of wants to be, yeah, low key. And then here it was like, I was going to bars and it was like, I was seeing fashion designers I recognized and artists, and it seemed like the pages of a magazine come to life, you know?
And Jeremy, you mentioned the dance floor. I don't know about you, but I kind of genuinely miss the dance floor these days. And it's interesting because I'm not someone that goes out a lot. I mean, you know, to dance, especially in recent years, which is a shame. What about you? I mean, do you miss it? Do you think, are those spaces, gay bars, do they really matter in the context of today? Do you think they will exist? Because I know they were in trouble even before the pandemic, but do you think there might be a resurgence of it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think probably one of the most predictable things will be that there will be a lot of roving parties, like more in the tradition of raves, and that those parties will probably very much belong to young people and people who haven't always been at the center of the gay scene. So queer people of color, trans people, women of various self-definitions. And I think that is a great thing. But I also think that what maybe threatens to be lost, or it's hard to imagine how, what form it'll take or if it'll continue, is just kind of like the regular bar in the center of town that the person who has a 9-to-5 job, well, these days, like a 9-to-6-7 job, goes to and unwinds, and maybe, like, you know, they're completely assimilated at work. But still, even in this day and age, there's a way that they might feel a bit more comfortable behaving in a room that has kind of identified itself as gay. So I've been a little bit sort of thinking about how we're so focused on the new forms that it's going to take, and for very good reason, because people need new forms. But it'll be interesting to see how that basic old boozer in the center of town that just provides a kind of a just sort of a refuge in the most gentle of ways, in terms of the fact that it just has an open door and a kind of anything goes policy. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if those can survive and if they can evolve alongside the new generation.
Thanks, Jeremy. And his book, Gay Bar, is out now, published by Granta. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. She's talking about wine, and she will certainly be played in gay bars. Here is Kylie Minogue with Fine Wine. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. Move like that, you dynamite. Show the world who you are.